Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has brought uncommon intelligence and great patriotic fervor and impressive professional competency to the subject of national security in the United States Congress is our first guest. I'm delighted to have him back. He is Congressman Scott Perry. He represents with great distinction the people of the 4th Congressional District of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, my home state. He is a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee. He serves as well in the House Homeland Security Committee, where he chairs its Oversight Subcommittee. He is also a member of the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. More caucuses than you can shake a stick at. But beyond all of that, he is these days a brigadier general in the Pennsylvania Army National Guard, having served his country in the active elements in combat for a number of years, including flying all kinds of rotary wing aircraft in the Army. An impressive and extraordinary friend of mine, I'm happy to say, as well as the cause of freedom, and always a welcome guest here. Congressman, thank you again for joining us.
Frank, thank you very much, and thanks for what you do.
Let me talk to you about a couple of things that you do, particularly what you and your colleagues have been up to of late in terms of some very important hearings. There was one in your committee, the Homeland Security Committee, that I'm particularly interested in. Two panels were recently asked to sort of review the threat of terrorism in the current era. One of the witnesses in the second of the two panels was Richard Cohen of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I'm kind of amazed, given the role that organization has been playing, attacking, among others, yours truly, that he would even be given a platform, let alone a chance to perform at some length as a witness before your committee. You asked some very probing questions, for which I'm very grateful. I'd like you to just to give us a sense of what's up with all of that.
Well, sure. It is a double-edged sword having these people, any witness come to before Congress to testify, because if they are what seem to be fringe actors, so to speak, it gives them some credibility. Not many people get to testify before Congress, but that having been said, it also lays bare for the world to see what their viewpoints are and how they interact with the rest of society. Now, the Republican Party is in charge, so to speak, and so they impanel the witnesses. But of course, the minority party gets to choose a certain portion of the witnesses as well on any of these panels. And these are decidedly Democrat witnesses. And so that's their choice. And I think it's important to point that out, because if you're concerned about the credibility of witnesses, these are Democrat witnesses. They don't come from the Republican Party. To that end, if you watch the hearing, you can clearly see or hear that the Southern Poverty Law Center has a very biased opinion in determining who are hate organizations, which individuals are involved in hate speech. And I think that the criteria is the opinion of the Southern Poverty Law Center. That's the criteria, such that people like like Frank Gaffney, but the Family Research Council, Ben Carson, individuals and organizations, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, end up as people regarded as haters, so to speak, and on their hate map. Meanwhile, groups like Antifa or the Black Lives Matter, et cetera, those individuals or groups, individuals associated with those groups aren't included.
And you took him to task on that very point, as I recall. You said something to the effect that you're clearly targeting not on the basis of empirical data.
Well, we asked them for their data. It's exactly right. I asked them for the data, how they what they use to determine who ends up in this hate category, because as you know, ending up in one of these hate categories can be exceptionally detrimental to your personal and professional life, which is, of course, the point. They're not interested in arguing the merits of people's beliefs or thoughts. They are interested in silencing and banishing from society individuals that disagree with their view, their worldview.
Oh, it's so well said. It's political warfare, I think, masquerading as some sort of objective criterion of monitoring hate. Let me ask you about another hearing, Congressman. The Judiciary Committee yesterday had before it the director of the FBI, Chris Wray, and one of your valued colleagues and I admire greatly, Jim Jordan, worked him over pretty well about, well, I think, as I'll be talking about with Bill Gertz shortly, the politicization of the Justice Department, certainly the FBI, in the past years, and concerns that may be continuing today with respect to this special counsel investigation. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, of course, Christopher Wray is new at the FBI, and he has got a handful of a can of worms in that place. And I think the biggest problem is that there are a bunch of holdovers from the previous administration, but it sure has the appearance that the FBI is no longer the pillar of justice and righteousness that many of us believed it would be, operating impartially within our society to make sure that they investigated crimes. It now looks like it's more like we absolutely need it to be, but it appears under the last administration, at least, it had become more of the secret police that no longer investigated crimes but investigated individuals. And that's what I think the bigger picture is that what is laid bare. The more micro picture is that the Hillary Clinton campaign looks like it trumped up this, pardon the pun, this dossier, which is just a fancy word for file, against President Trump. They paid for it through various organizations,
including the Russians, for God's sake.
That's right, exactly. And then got that to the FBI, who dressed it up and used it to get a foreign intelligence surveillance approval to spy on American citizens, including those people close to the Trump transition team, the Trump campaign, and those folks. And then, of course, what we're seeing now proceeding in law is people that are pleading guilty and people that are having their doors broken in the deep of the night and dragged before the courts, and that is the deep state. That is a police state, and I think that we need to get to those answers, because we need to know how this occurred and who did it.
And along the other way, people being unmasked, their rights being infringed upon, the political use of intelligence for these purposes, and so on. There's the case of this fellow Peter Strzok that I wonder whether you're as troubled by as I am, his role in the Bureau, in the Clinton investigations, and now in this Mueller business.
Well, of course we're concerned. And as Representative Jordan from Ohio very clearly laid out what he has been involved in, he was involved, of course, in the amnesty for Cheryl Mills and Heather Samuelson and other folks, the IT gentleman that handled Hillary Clinton's server, and then Huma Abedin, and then also involved in Michael Flynn's testimony or deposition, and then was removed unceremoniously and sent to Human Resources. Now, some people are saying that's not a demotion, but few people on the planet were going to see that as an upgrade. But the bigger point is, if the issue were that he is a partisan and he did not like President Trump or didn't approve of him, and that was the rationale for removing him and sending him over to HR, if that's the criteria, it seems like everybody on the special prosecutor or special investigator's team would be banished, because they all have political leanings that are clearly hard to the hard left and to Hillary Clinton in particular. So the question, it begs the question, what else is there? And of course, the supposition is that this guy, Peter Strzok, is the guy that ordered up the dossier or at least participated in getting it to the FISA court, which is the premise, which is the foundation for this entire investigation that has rocked the country for the better part of a year now.
Indeed. Congressman, we have to pause for just a moment. You've graciously agreed to give us another segment. We have much more to talk about with Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania. Further developments on the Hill in terms of hearings and the departure, alas, it appears, of one of his most distinguished and I think most valued colleagues, Congressman Trent Franks. We'll be speaking with Scott Perry about all that and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are speaking with Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee's Oversight Subcommittee, a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and a very prominent figure in terms of national security leadership on Capitol Hill these days, a brigadier general in the Pennsylvania Army National Guard, as well as a combat veteran. Congressman, thank you for your further time. Let me ask you about another hearing, actually two, in your Foreign Affairs Committee, one at the full committee level yesterday, terrorism in Africa, and kind of a similar hearing the day before in the Africa Subcommittee. I was struck again by one of the witnesses in the latter, a fellow by the name of Saeed Saeed, a figure in an organization called the Islamic Society of North America, when it has been identified by the Justice Department as a Muslim Brotherhood front organization. Again, it's a question of legitimizing organizations like this that's worrying. I gather that was another Democratic witness. But tell us about these hearings, if you would, and the advisability of taking testimony from the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, that, of course, let's start with the Muslim Brotherhood, an organization started specifically for the furtherance of Islamism and the downfall of Western civilization at their hand. And of course, the Muslim Brotherhood is the kind of instrument by which that's supposed to occur. And of course, as you know, Frank, many countries around the globe, or several countries around the globe, have listed them as a terrorist organization. The United States, much to my dismay, has not yet, but it is troubling when your own Justice Department is very concerned about them and lists them as so and investigates them as terrorist organizations and front groups, then these individuals on their behalf are testifying in front of Congress. That's very troubling indeed. But again, it is a Democrat witness, so that should inform your listeners as well. To that end, we have been in Africa for a long time trying to win the hearts and minds there on what we would call more of a civil affairs mission, trying to show the good face of America and that we're interested and keenly aware of their poverty and how they could do better for themselves with the Western model. And of course, that is a bulwark against the Islamists, the terrorists affiliated with Islam that are also operating in Africa. But the change has come now where we can literally see casualties in Africa. The mission set, unfortunately, has changed from at least it has to. That, I think, is the issue at hand. It goes from changing hearts and minds and maybe digging wells and providing assistance in crop growth and those type of things to being on patrol and advising the nation states there about how to defeat these folks on a military basis. Unfortunately, some of our great American soldiers, service members, were caught up in that about a month or two ago and were murdered, were killed on the battlefield. And America was not expecting that. And that's what I think the premise of these hearings is.
It's raising awareness and understanding of the threat that's emerging there. Congressman, speaking of that region more generally, we'll be talking momentarily with Ambassador Yoram Edinger from Israel. I'd love to get your thoughts on the president's decision to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to the capital of Israel, Jerusalem, recognize it as such, and the possibility that this may precipitate some violent reaction around the world.
Yeah, well, I, for one, am thrilled. The president said when he was on the campaign trail that he intended to do it. And just to make it clear for everybody, since the state of Israel has been present, that was always the intent of the United States But it was waived every 6 months. So every 6 months, as a president, regardless, Democrat, Republican, administration after administration since that time, has basically said, yeah, we're going to move the embassy, but we're just going to hold off for 6 months. This president finally said, you know what, we're not going to hold off anymore. And I think it breaks or potentially breaks the stalemate, because the Palestinians and the people that knife Jews and kill Jews in Israel have always used that as a bargaining chip. But they have shown themselves over these decades to not be sincere, because we have held off on moving the embassy and they continue to kill Jews and train their children and teach their children to kill the Jewish people. So I think the president has done what everybody instinctively knows. We're going to move our embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing the capital of Israel as Jerusalem, where the president lives, where their Supreme Court resides, where their legislature, the Knesset, is. You know, Israel deserves the right to determine where their own capital is. And how would we as Americans feel if the international community said, well, your capital is not in Washington, D.C., it's in Iowa somewhere, it's in North Dakota. Yeah, that's for Israel to decide.
Amen. Let me ask you, this really raises a larger question, of course, about our relationship with the Palestinians, who have never, as far as I can tell, abandoned not only their desire to destroy Israel, but in furtherance of sort of the Sharia supremacism of their community, envisions, as you said earlier, about the Muslim Brotherhood taking down Western civilization more generally. The Taylor Force Act has been approved by your committee. I'm a little unclear as to whether it's gotten through the full House yet or not, but talk about the desirability of cutting off funding by the United States to this organization that remains committed to terrorism and jihad.
Well, that's exactly right, Frank. And if Americans knew that their tax dollars were going to pay what they're called stipends to terrorists who kill Jews, who knife Jews, who shoot them, who blow them up with bombs, literally our tax dollars go to pay for they're actually rewarded. So if one of these Palestinians does this, kills a Jewish person or takes some kind of hostile action for that, they are literally rewarded with a payment, and their family is rewarded while they're in prison. They call these stipends, and the American taxpayers pay for that. By passing the Taylor Force Act, which the House did within the last 2 days, we're on the road to stopping those payments.
Good. And Taylor Force, of course, was not Jewish. He was an American veteran who was murdered by these guys as well. Let me ask you also, if I could, Congressman, about one other very important topic, I think, to both of us, and that is the announcement yesterday of one of your colleagues, Congressman Trent Franks, a dear personal friend of mine, I think of yours as well, that he's going to resign from the Congress. I hope he'll be dissuaded from doing that, but would you just talk about what his departure might mean to our cause?
Trent is a very, very knowledgeable and outspoken advocate of our national security, and particularly things like our electricity grid. He is a well-renowned expert on the grid and the electromagnetic pulse threat that we face, as well as our anti-missile defense shield. He is a salt of the earth guy. He would never hurt a flea. And I was just so crestfallen to hear the news. And I will tell you, certainly I don't know the facts, but I would say, you know, that what he's been accused of is not sexual harassment. And I wish that he would stand and fight as opposed to walk away. But in this climate, I understand it's easy to say when you're not involved in it. It is a very, you know, it's a guilty until proven innocent environment based on any accusation. He is going to be a huge loss to the Congress and to the American people and to the people of Arizona.
Well, it is going to make all the more important, of course, the work that you do, Congressman Scott Perry, and your leadership in trying to cover so many of these topics. And as we've discussed in the course of these two segments, you're making an outsized contribution. I can't tell you how much we appreciate it. I think all of us who know, as you do, firsthand, the importance of national security mindedness in an era in which there's altogether too little of that, either in Congress or in the public at large. And you bring it to bear with extraordinary effect, and I thank you for your leadership, both in the committees on which you serve and in the House more generally. And we look forward to your continued help to our country in all of these areas, and standing with you in accomplishing it. So, God bless you, sir, and I hope you'll keep up the good work in the remainder of this Congress and come back to us very soon to report on how it's going. Next up, we'll speak with Ambassador Yoram Edinger, who will be giving us a personal, firsthand account of what's happening in Israel in the aftermath of President Trump's announcement. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He is an extraordinary diplomat of the State of Israel, a man of great accomplishments since he left that foreign service. But in his time during his service to his country, among other places in Washington, he became really a go-to man for the Congress, which he was a minister to a liaison with for the Israeli embassy in Washington, as well as the Consul General for Israel in the southwestern United States. He has, therefore, an extraordinary acumen about what is America's interest, not just the interest of Israel, in important developments in that region. We've caught up with him in Israel, and I'm delighted to say he's prepared to share some thinking he's been doing about the president's movement of the embassy to the capital of Israel, Jerusalem. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
In a product that you generate called the Edinger Report, Mr. Ambassador, you have recently laid out a number of very compelling reasons why it is in America's vital interest, not just Israel's, to have taken the step President Trump announced this week. Would you just quickly give us a sense of those?
Well, refraining from relocating the embassy to Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, has been perceived, and rightly so, by Arabs in the Middle East and by the world as a whole, as an American subordinating themselves to Arab pressure, Muslim pressure, threats of terrorism, which has eroded the U.S. posture of deterrence, which has had an impact on the larger context of U.S. policy in the Middle East and beyond the Middle East. And therefore, for the U.S. to eventually, hopefully promptly, relocate the embassy to Jerusalem would reinstate the U.S. posture of deterrence. In addition, we have today in the world a major decline of the Europeans. And for the U.S. to follow in the European vein, namely vacillation in face of pressure, plays into the hands of U.S. adversaries and U.S. Enemies. The U.S. is very involved in an attempt to produce an arrangement between Israel and the Palestinians to expand the Israeli-Arab peace process. But for the U.S. not to relocate the embassy to Jerusalem forces the Arabs to outflank the U.S. from the maximalist, from the radical side, which does present an additional hurdle to the peace process, which already has very slim chance of being resolved peacefully.
Yeah. Mr. Ambassador, I want to come back to the peace process in a moment, but let me just ask you about the point you just made, that it would hopefully be promptly the case that the embassy is moved. I spoke earlier in the program with Congressman Scott Perry, who's a great supporter, as am I, of this initiative of President Trump's, but I am concerned that if the embassy is not established quickly, and I would say overnight, by turning the American consulate that has been operating for some time in Western Jerusalem into an interim embassy for us, that the pressure inevitably will mount to postpone or drag out or simply scupper altogether this initiative. Would you address that proposition?
Sure. Should the U.S. Refrain from implementing this such a relocation and limit itself only to the talk rather than the walk, that would, in my mind, exacerbate the damage to America's posture of deterrence, because the message would be, even when the U.S. talks the right way, they don't walk that way.
It is perceived as submission, as you say. Very much the wrong sort of message to send to these characters, the Sharia supremacists.
Now, this is not only an issue limited to the U.S. posture of deterrence. U.S. posture of deterrence is a critical element to ensure the survival of pro-American Arab regimes. And for the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, Bahrain, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, to rely on a U.S. with a slackened posture of deterrence would once again play of the Ayatollahs and other rogue elements in the region and in the world.
Yeah, our enemies as well as Israel's. And Ambassador Yoram Edinger, let me just ask you on that point. There has been a very important initiative, I think, mounted by our friend Dr. Daniel Pipes and his splendid organization, the Middle East Forum, to promote a different attitude, if you will, towards this whole peace process, for want of a better expression. Namely, that it be undertaken in the context of what I think is, frankly, the reality that Israel was victorious in its previous wars, notably 1967, and that whatever is to be discussed at this point is properly done only in the terms of its decisive victory, and that the Palestinians, and for that matter other Arabs, were decisively defeated. Could the embassy's move be seen as a step in that direction, and if so, is that desirable?
Well, absolutely. When it comes to facing rogue elements, terror regimes, there are two ways of addressing it. One way is an attempt to soothe their appetite, to appease them, to compromise with them, to commit yourself to certain concessions. But as we have learned from history, that such an option only whets the appetite, only further radicalizes those rogue and terror regimes. The other option is to deliver a message to rogue regimes that terror and war work. And in fact, it only backfires. And therefore, relocating the embassy as promptly as possible would send a very determined, very decisive message. I have no doubt that such a move would trigger barrage, a flood of anti-American talk. But in the long run, it's going to produce a very substantial pro-American walk.
Right. And in that connection, Mr. Ambassador, you're there on the ground in the Middle East. I think there's a lot of people holding their breath to see what comes out of the mosques in the Friday religious ceremonies in Israel and the Palestinian areas and beyond. Do you anticipate that some of that immediate response from the Palestinians and other Arab states will be, in fact, a new intifada, new acts of violence against Israel?
Obviously, this is an option, but once again, we cannot subordinate long-term interest to short-term convenience. And the question is, what does the long-interest strategic agreement require? And I can rely only on history. In fact, 70 years ago, when Israel was about to declare independence, our founding father Ben-Gurion was pressured brutally by the State Department and the CIA to refrain from such declaration, and their assessment was that Mr. Ben-Gurion would bring rivers of blood, of Jewish blood, upon the Jewish people. His decision was to go ahead, and it was a rational decision, because he realized that there are no free lunches, and if the Jewish nation wants an independent Jewish state, then the Jewish nation must be ready to pay for that.
We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk with you about. Good luck through this important transitional period. I hope you'll come back to us again in the very near future. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. We'll visit with him about what's been happening in Washington's Inside the Ring right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's good to have with us Bill Gertz, a regular on this program, the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, and a prize-winning columnist at the Washington Times. Bill is, of course, also a best-selling author many times over, including most recently his new book, iWars, War and Peace in the Information Age. We are catching up with him at a moment when there is a lot to talk about, and in his inimitable way, he is helping shed light on some of the really troubling indications of politicization of the national security community, and I'm delighted to have a chance to visit with him about it. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, let's start with a piece that you wrote about a very, very important topic, Bill, and that is the politicization of the FBI, which, as you point out, has been going on for some time under the leadership of two individuals who are very much in the center of national security and political controversies at the moment. Talk about your insights into all of that.
Yeah, this was a piece that I did for the Free Beacon this week, and it looks at basically how the FBI has changed. It became the premier crime-fighting agency for many years, and then beginning around 2001 under Robert Mueller, who's now the special counsel, and later under James Comey, it has been politicized in the leftward direction. I think your listeners certainly know about the purge of all the Islamic training at the FBI. This was done under pressure from Islamic groups. That was kind of the beginning point, but it actually began probably under the Clinton administration and continued through Bush 43. And I look at this problem from a number of areas, just about how the FBI has changed its culture.
Yeah. One of the things that's been worrying me about the Bureau for a long time, and again, it started under Robert Mueller, it's continued as best I can tell today, and that is the sort of willful blindness that they've engaged in with respect to the nature of our Sharia supremacist adversaries, you know, in, among other things, embracing the Muslim Brotherhood as partners in their efforts to reach out to the Muslim community, and ignoring the threats that that organization and its ilk pose to us. Is that an example in your mind?
Yes. It's a huge problem. I mean, it's just a huge problem of failing to understand the nature of the Islamic threat, and it's dooming us to kind of an endless warfare that we're trying to fight this problem overseas without really addressing the ideological component of it.
Let alone understanding it here at home. Yeah, this is really, and especially if, you know, the Bureau is supposed to be the first lines of defense against that. Jim Jordan, by the way, as I'm sure you know, Bill, had a very interesting exchange with the current director of the FBI, Chris Wray, yesterday, sort of teasing out some of these concerns about specifically the probe that you were just talking about a moment, or alluding to a moment ago, involving the Clintons and some of their misconduct, which, you know, is something that isn't getting the attention it deserves, but is seemingly very much at work in the special counsel's activities.
Yes. And of course, now I think the thing that kind of brought it home was this discovery that one of the key FBI agents involved in Russian counterintelligence activities was reassigned because he issued a bunch of anti-Trump emails. And now we've seen also it's reached the Justice Department as well, where you have a senior Justice Department official who reports came out yesterday that Bruce Orr, was someone who was actually met with this Christopher Steele character that was the basis for basically the false premises for this entire Trump collusion narrative.
Right. Which brings us, if I can, to a related subject. Bill Gertz, you've written in the Free Beacon today about the use of the intelligence community for political purposes as well. Talk about Eric Prince's recent testimony before the House Intelligence Committee on that subject.
Yeah, Eric Prince is a former Navy SEAL and founder of the Blackwater security firm, and he was testified voluntarily before the House Intelligence Committee on November 30th, and his testimony was just released this week, and it was quite eye-opening in the sense that he refuted one of the main stories that came out alleging Russian collusion, and this was in the Washington Post on April, in the April time frame, where the Post, according to Eric Prince, relied on classified electronic intelligence intercepts to write about a meeting that he, Eric Prince, had had with a senior UAE official in the Seychelles, which is an island chain in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Africa. And the allegation in the Post was that this was Prince supposedly establishing a back channel between the incoming Trump administration and Russia. And it was ludicrous on its face, since the meeting was like January 11th, which was just days before the inauguration. Why would he need to set up a back channel? He was actually trying to do some business there. And the disclosure in the Post, which Prince said was because this intelligence was leaked, actually hurt his business. So he has grounds to sue if he were so inclined to do that, but I don't think he is.
But he is raising an alarm about the use of intelligence assets for political purposes, rightly so, it seems to me.
This is the kind of thing that is done in a police state.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, Bill, one other issue of concern in terms of politicization of the military. You've reported on this week about this issue of a Green Beret instructor down at the Kennedy School in at Fort Bragg, saying standards are being reduced for the Green Beret. I talked with Colonel Joe Martin, a former instructor in that school, about this earlier in the week. But give us your thoughts on what's happening there and whether we should be concerned about the military getting politicized as well.
Yeah, this is an important story again. The Green Beret trainer issued a very, very critical letter. He did it anonymously, but it was clear from the details that he provided that the trainers there, the leaders of the school, were guilty of careerism. In other words, they were lowering the training standards with what this anonymous officer said was in order to produce the first female Green Beret. This is contrary to everything that the Army has said about integrating women into combat roles, was that they wouldn't lower standards. The Army's response was commanding officer issued a statement that suggested he was going to investigate and try to find out who leaked this information rather than address the issue at hand.
It's not a good sign, and I think there's probably a lot more where that comes from, and we appreciate your investigative reporting on that and so many other issues. Lastly, let me ask you quickly about Congressman Trent Franks. I spoke earlier in the program with one of his colleagues, Scott Perry, about his resignation. You've known him well for years, and I know admire him as I do as a serious leader in the national security space. What would his departure from the Congress mean in that regard to your way of thinking, Bill Gertz?
Well, yeah, it's a big loss. Trent Franks has been one of the most outspoken supporters of U.S. missile defenses, and I've covered his case for a number of years. And one of the things that he did was he was able to get legislation added to the Defense Authorization Act a couple of years ago, which forced the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency to set up a special office to deal with the maneuvering high-speed missile threat. And this is, I think, one of his legacies, that at least he got some progress on that issue.
If we haven't yet solved the problem, yeah, at least they're now addressing it. And I have to say as well, his incredibly important work on the whole threat to our electric grid and electromagnetic pulse. It's a terrible loss. I hope yet to persuade him not to do this, but we'll be praying on this. Bill Gertz, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time and your great work at the Free Beacon and the Washington Times, and always with us, of course. Come back to us again next week. George Raceley joins us. We'll talk next with him about this politicization in the Justice Department and elsewhere.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by George Raceley. He is the editor of Conservative HQ, a terrific online resource, a product of the Richard Viguerie organization. He is a man of great distinction, among other things, a member of the American Mensa organization, which qualifies him as a pedigreed genius, which I have discovered him to be. He's also worked in government, including, among other things, on the staff of then Vice President Dan Quayle in the George H.W. Bush administration. He's a dear friend and a valued colleague, and it's always a delight to have him with us. Welcome back, George.
Thanks for having me, Frank, and congratulations to you for receiving the Impact Award the other day. It was great to see you at the luncheon with Sean Hannity and so many distinguished guests.
It was one of the great honors of my life. Thank you for mentioning it. And if people want to see the proceedings, you can check it out at our website, securefreedom.org. I commend it to you, especially if you are feeling a little disconsolate about what's going on in our country these days. There were real heroes in that room, and I was privileged to be somehow included among them. Let me ask you, George, to talk a bit about an issue we discussed earlier in the program with Scott Perry and Bill Gertz, in fact, and that is what seems to be increasingly kind of... the Hillary Rodham Clinton campaign now doing business as the special counsel. What on earth is going on here?
Well, I wish I could explain it any better than you've just summarized it. But what is being revealed is that Mueller's team are, in fact, an extension of the Hillary campaign and the Obama administration. And they are, because of working for Mueller, seemingly immune to the rules and regulations and expectations regarding conflicts of interest and bias that would normally accrue to a investigation and a prosecution.
Particularly if there were any Republicans in the equation, right?
Yeah. And I mean, here you have a guy who's exchanged 10,000 some texts with his mistress, who is also involved in the investigation.
One would think that would pretty much be a full-time job, just doing 10,000 texts, for God's sake.
Yeah, I was going to say I can barely answer the four or five I get every day. If this guy were in corporate America...
We're talking about here Peter Strzok, this FBI agent, counterintelligence official, we're told. Go ahead.
He would have lost his security clearance. He would have been fired. And yet, there he is still raking in probably a GS-15 or above salary and going merrily along and investigating essentially whoever he wants and changing... Comey's speech exonerating Hillary before she was even interviewed, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just amazing.
It's truly scandalous on so many different counts. And as you say, the question of how this could be done without it, being a problem from a conflict of interest point of view, and how Robert Mueller could possibly be not now held accountable for populating his staff with such partisans and his own partisanship, for that matter. Is really unbelievable.
I mean, I've worked for a Fortune 500 company, and if something like this were going on, it would not just be the employee, but the employee's boss who would be heading out the door in disgrace. And yet these guys are completely immune.
There does seem to me to be a bit of a miscarriage of justice going on with respect to what has been done by Robert Mueller and his team most recently with respect to General Michael Flynn. You've written a piece at Conservative HQ about his only crime. Talk about that, if you would, George Rice.
Yeah, well, Flynn's only crime was not lying. It was telling the truth about how Obama, Clinton, and their administration put this country in jeopardy by making the Iran deal, by selling out to radical Islamic terrorists.
Yeah, Sharia supremacism more generally, right. And this brought him their wrath, I think it's fair to say. And while he did apparently mislead the FBI, that does not constitute, as far as you're concerned, a criminal act?
Well, I think there's a great deal of question about the circumstances of that. And I think that Flynn, you know, was interviewed without the benefit of counsel, that he was basically ambushed. I think had this gone to trial, any, legal aid lawyer would have made a motion to throw all of that stuff out. But Flynn was being crushed by the bills of trying to defend himself. He wanted his life back. You know, his son was threatened. So I think he took what was the cheapest way out, as opposed to necessarily standing and fighting. And a guy at his age, you know, I can't frankly blame him, even though I think it's a complete travesty that he was put in that position.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. George, let me turn to another topic that you've also addressed, I believe, just today at Conservative HQ, and that involves the apparent determination of a goodly number of Republicans. Goodly may not be the right term for this. There's nothing good about it. But a fair number of Republican rhinos, I think you've called them, Republicans in name only, who are insisting, as evidently is the desire of their leadership, on giving an amnesty of as yet undetermined proportions in the name of addressing this question of deferred action for childhood arrivals or DACA population. What on earth are they thinking, and what's likely to come of it as you see it?
Well, of course, they're pandering to the open borders, depress the wages of working Americans, clique of the Chamber of Commerce. But I think that 32 plus have signed on to this letter, which demands a DACA be addressed by the end of the year. And that's enough to foul up the tax reform package or pretty much anything else leadership wants to do. And so the concern is that these unprincipled scoundrels will buffalo the House leadership into putting something up, you know, that will amnesty these DACA recipients, which could be in the neighborhood of 1 million or more.
I've heard a number as high as 3 million. I don't think we have any idea, but if there's 800,000 of them in the first place, the chain migration would certainly be multiples of that, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, because for every two immigrants that you bring in, they're likely to bring in, or the average is, seven more family members.
And as you pointed out in your piece, George, the first two in that chain migration would presumably be the parents who perpetrated the crime in the first place, right? Talk about rewarding and incentivizing more of it.
But anyway, so, you know, the concern is that if this gets on the floor between those 32 or so and the Democrats, then it would easily pass the House. So we need to make sure that everybody understands that that is a poison pill, and that anybody that votes for that is going to get a primary challenge, and that the conservatives are going to vigorously oppose not just the bill, but the people in their next election.
From your lips to God's ears, George Wesley, and I know you will be doing what you can as the editor of Conservative HQ and as a leader of the conservative movement to make it so. And I strongly support you in doing it, and am very concerned that this betrayal, should it go down, of the conservatives will cost the country, for sure, but also the Republican majority in the House should it take place. We'll talk more about this in the days ahead. George, we have to leave it at that for the moment, though. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.